Coming up today, what's the objective evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Dr. Timothy Paul Jones, author of the book, Did the Resurrection Really Happen?, will explain the evidence for the resurrection and how we can present that to skeptics.
By the time the eyewitnesses begin to die out, the 50s and 60s and 70s, when that's happening, there is persecution from the Jewish synagogues among the Jews who had not confessed Jesus as Messiah. There is persecution from the Romans beginning in 64 after the fire in Rome. You've got both sides are coming in persecuting, and yet these eyewitnesses persist all the way to the point of death.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Jeff Shambly, and this is The Stand Radio. Well, thank you for being with us this weekend. It is a great weekend as we celebrate the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ, the once central event to the Christian faith, and the event that, frankly, has forever changed the world. However, the authenticity of the resurrection as a literal historical event has been challenged for centuries, in fact, from the very beginning. What evidence do we have for the resurrection, and how do we communicate that evidence to the skeptics that might be around us? Well, joining me to answer those questions is Dr. Timothy Paul Jones. He's Vice President for Doctoral Studies at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and Chair of the Department of Apologetics, Ethics, and Philosophy. He's the author of numerous books, including his latest booklet titled, Did the Resurrection Really Happen? Dr. Jones, it's great to have you with us today.
It is great to be with you.
You know, Christians can go through periods of doubt on any number of issues, including the resurrection. And in your booklet, you write about a time when you yourself went through a time of crisis of belief in college. What was that like, and how did you handle that?
Well, what it was like was extremely scary, extremely frightening for me. And I think that is for a lot of people. And I think we need to help people not be afraid of the fear that they may feel when they're struggling with their faith. Mm-hmm. But what happened for me is I got to college, and it was a Christian college. It wasn't that people were attacking my faith directly in any way, shape, or form, but the way I had been raised to believe the Bible was not able to handle the facts I was learning about the Bible. And because of that, I ended up having just a deep season of doubt. And I was working in the library at the time. That was my job. And I remember going to the shelf and pulling off a book by Bertrand Russell called Why I Am Not a Christian. And I read that book as I'm feeling this frustration with the faith I'd been raised in, and that I read the next book on the shelf and the next book. This was the section of atheist books. And I began reading that, and within a few months of doing that, I was at a place where the main thing I was asking myself is, how do I tell my family that I've walked away from the faith? And so it was a very frightening, very terrifying thing, and I understand that fear, but it was really the evidence that God worked through and the grace that God showed through evidence that God used to draw me back to himself from that deep period of doubt.
Do you think it was because the hard questions about the resurrection and about Jesus were never asked when you were growing up?
I think so. I mean, it truly was that those questions were simply not asked at all. And I believe the Bible. I believe the Bible strongly. It's not that I think that we can't ask questions about the Bible or anything like that, or that we should somehow doubt the Bible. I don't believe we should, but we ought to have space in our churches for people to ask honest questions about the Bible. And that's what I didn't have. And that was what I was hungry for during that time.
Hmm. You mentioned the faith that comes alongside the evidence that we have, but you point out that the world's definition of faith is not the same as the believer's. What is the difference between those two worlds?
Well, one of the things you find is particularly among atheists, Richard Dawkins and people like that, but also more recent writers as well, there is an assumption that faith means believing something without evidence. And that's simply not true. That's never been true for Christians. There's never been a time when Christians have said faith is belief with absolutely no evidence, in the absolute absence of evidence. It's simply not true. In Christianity, faith has always come alongside evidence. And that is to say that we believe, yes, and we have a faith that's seeking understanding, but that faith seeking understanding doesn't mean that something that's to the exclusion of faith. It's something that God gives alongside evidence, faith and evidence alongside one another. And so this notion that many people have that faith excludes evidence misunderstands the longstanding Christian understanding of faith.
You mentioned earlier some of the books that you had read, Bertrand Russell being one of those, and he referring to some of the other resurrection myths that are common in the world. When you look at ancient documents, what are some of the uniquenesses of Jesus' resurrection as compared to some of the more common run-of-the-mill pagan myths of the resurrection?
That was one of the things that was really a question for me that I wrestled with at that time. It was very difficult for me because of the fact that I read some of these things that said the pagan parallels to Jesus show that the resurrection was false. That was the argument. Because they said, look, there's all these dying, rising gods in all of these other places all the way around the world. Why should we believe that Jesus was really raised from the dead when we don't believe all these other dying, rising gods were raised from the dead? And that sounded to me at the time like a very compelling reason not to believe. But what I realized in the years after that, and as I explored this, what I've recognized is, first off, and most importantly, the parallels really aren't that parallel. If you go back and you look at the actual sources, what you find, for example, with the dying rising gods, almost all of those are agricultural cycles. In other words, it's the dying rising god dies and rises every year, and it has to do with the agricultural cycles. None of those are tied to particular places and particular people with evidences in history. They're never tied to that. And so what we see is that the parallels aren't as parallel as people think they are. Even in ones like the ones in the Egyptian ones of Horus and some of the things related to that, even that one is very, very different. It is somebody is bitten by a snake and then is revived, and there's a moon god involved on all of that. What you see even in that is that it's not the same as the accounts of the resurrection of Jesus, which tie the resurrection of Jesus to a very particular place at a very particular time with particular eyewitnesses. And so what I would say is that when we see these dying rising gods, what it should do is what C.S. Lewis describes in Myth Became Fact when he talks about this, and he says that what we should understand is that there is this notion in which people know that there's a truth to a death resurrection. They know that. And so they put it into their myths. But what happens in Jesus is that the myth becomes fact. That is to say that the pagans are in some sense doing the best they can do to be able to respond to the longings of their hearts by creating these stories. But the truth is that that truth they're yearning for is made real in history at a particular place, at a particular time in Jesus Christ. And that's how we should understand those pagan parallels.
Very, very good. That's exciting. Take us inside the Roman mind. I want to get inside the Jewish mind and the Roman mind to see what they expected when they first heard the gospel about the resurrection. So let's start with the Romans. Paul comes to the Romans and he's preaching the resurrection in a Roman mind. What are you hearing and thinking at that point?
Well, we get a really good glimpse into that in Acts 17, and we've got to think of Greek and Roman together in some sense, but we get a good glimpse of that, especially the Greek way of thinking in Acts 17, and some of the same challenges would be faced in a Roman way of thinking. And so Paul's talking about this, and he begins talking about the resurrection, and they bring him in to hear more about this resurrection that he's talking about, but it's very clear that what they are hearing is probably something like a spiritual resurrection, something like a spiritual new life. Because for the Greeks and the Romans alike, you would never want to have a body back once you leave it behind. You don't want to keep your body. You don't want your body to be revivified. You don't want your body renewed. You want to leave your body behind. And so at the end of Paul's sermon in Acts 17, he mentions the resurrection, and they clearly understand this as a physical resurrection, and they think it's crazy. That's why it says, Paul, when he's writing it later on, he says, look, it's foolishness to the Greeks. Why is it foolishness to the Greeks? It's foolishness because of the fact that once you leave a physical body behind, you don't want it back. And so that was part of the scandal of the resurrection from the Greek standpoint, was that, look, you don't want that body back. Why would somebody do this? Any self-respecting God would leave his body behind and would ascend to the stars, or would ascend to some high place in a spiritual realm. That's where he would go. He's not going to get his body back. That makes no sense from their perspective. Looking at Jesus, that would have been the scandal that they would have seen in that.
So the goal is freedom from the body. Is that right?
Yes, that would be correct. Okay, okay. From the Greek way of thinking in particular.
Hmm. We're talking with Dr. Timothy Paul Jones. His booklet is entitled, Did the Resurrection Really Happen? Okay, Dr. Jones, that's the Roman mind. Let's look at the Jewish mind. What did the Pharisees, we know what the Sadducees thought about the resurrection, but let's go to the Pharisees, the typical Jewish community. What did they expect with the resurrection, and how was Jesus different from that?
So with the Pharisees, those that believed in the resurrection, as you already noted, the Sadducees didn't believe in any sort of resurrection. The Pharisees did. So that part of the Jews that would have expected some sort of a resurrection, what they were expecting is the resurrection of all the righteous, or perhaps of all humanity. There's different views on that. But they would have been expecting a corporate resurrection at the end of time. And so what happens with Jesus is an individual resurrection. And now it is the first fruits of what is yet to come, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And there were some other people raised during this time as well, because we have the saints that burst forth from their tombs and they were walking about in the city. But it's still not the type of corporate resurrection that was expected in Judaism. They expected an eschatological, that is to say, at the end of time, a corporate resurrection. So what happens with Jesus is unexpected by both Greek and Jew. So the Jews don't expect it to happen at an individual level in time. They expect it to happen corporately at the end of time, not in time here and now. And the Greeks would have been expecting something that didn't involve a physical body at all. So this is not something anybody was really expecting to happen in quite the way that it did.
So if you're going to invent a religion, you don't choose the one thing that no one is looking for.
That is exactly it. If you're going to invent this, there are so many things wrong with it if you're going to invent it. You're not going to invent something that is so radically odd, different, and new. You're not going to invent something in which the first witness is a woman the empty tomb, because that's something that would have brought it into question because of the questions about a woman's testimony on a legal basis in their world. So you wouldn't have done that. You certainly would not have had it be somebody who had been crucified, because that was in itself, that was the most horrific of deaths, and was one that was a vulgar, awful death that people perceived in the worst possible ways as a curse. None of those are what you would fabricate if you're going to fabricate a new religion.
Let's get into some of the other things. How did the written accounts of the resurrection come about? Because every one of the four gospel writers has the resurrection. So where did these things come from?
So what we have first is that they were telling it as a story to one another. And we have evidence of that in, for example, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So Paul, he tells the Corinthians, and remember, Paul's not necessarily having the best and smoothest relationship with the Corinthians at this time. Okay. So you kind of can be certain that Paul is not doing anything to call his integrity into question. Okay. But notice in 1 Corinthians 15 what he does there. It's absolutely fascinating. He says, remember what I proclaimed to you before. Now, he had been in Corinth a few years earlier. And so what Paul is implicitly letting us know right there is that the same message he is preaching, he preached there, is the one he's preaching everywhere he goes. Paul's not changing the message. So that snippet we have in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 7, is something that Paul has received and he is passing it on unchanged. Now, where, when did Paul receive that? Even critical scholars, scholars who are criticizing the New Testament, they recognize that this tradition emerges within a very short time after the claims of Jesus's resurrection in the 30s AD. So it's beginning to circulate in this brief account in the 30s. Now, what begins to happen then later on is that we reach a point at which the eyewitnesses are beginning to die out or to be killed in the 60s. And so when the eyewitnesses begin to be lost, there gets to be an urgency about writing down the full story. And so we have the Gospel of Mark and then the other Gospels emerging at that time to preserve the accounts of the eyewitnesses. And so all four of those Gospels in different ways can be traced back to eyewitness accounts, but they are preceded by an oral history that they're being told and it's being repeated that is not being changed as Paul travels from place to place and is apparently not being changed from what he received. So this account of the resurrection is something that has a solid history, a reliable history that is traceable to the places, to the times, and to the people that actually experienced these events.
If you will, talk to the importance of that issue, because you write that it is important to trace the accounts back to the time and place where the events happened. So why is that important in terms of the validation of the resurrection?
Well, one of the most important things is the same thing we know in a court of law, and that is simply that eyewitness testimony, though it can be in error at times, we recognize that, we admit that, but eyewitness testimony is the best thing that we have to understand what really happened. And so eyewitness testimony, testimony of people who were actually there, is very important for an event like this. And the resurrection is this momentous event that is reported in generally the same way in multiple places. So not only do we have eyewitness accounts, but we have multiple eyewitness accounts that are not identical to one another, but they tell the same basic story. And on that, it's the same thing as if you're a parent, you recognize when you are a parent that one of your key goals as a parent is to find out which kid is telling the truth and which one is lying. And one of the things you do, or at least I do, put them in different rooms and say, all right, you tell me the story. Then I go to the other room, you tell me the story. And I'm trying to figure out which one is telling me the truth about things. And it's important to be able to do that. But we do that recognizing that although there may be differences in the accounts of what happened, we're looking for things that are similar, the same. Then we're asking which one is more reliable. Then we're asking something else. Which one is doing what we would call it's called an admission against interest is the term for it. That is something that they admit that is not in their best interest. And again, you see that in the New Testament. So you see eyewitness accounts, but you also see what I would call admissions against interest. There are things told in there that don't put Christians, and certainly sometimes don't even put the person, some of the key people, in the best light. And yet they tell these things anyway. Well, that tells us not only that these are eyewitness accounts, but that these are eyewitness accounts which have an interest in telling the truth. The same thing as with Mary Magdalene as the first witness. That's something that you're not going to put in unless you're very deeply interested in telling the truth about what actually happened. It's something that it's an admission against interest. If you are fabricating it, you're not going to make that up because it could hurt your case. Yet they tell it because that's the way it actually happened. That's how we should be thinking about these accounts. The same thing as we think in a court of law or when you're talking to your kids trying to figure out who's telling the truth. Is you're asking what's reliable, who saw this, who was actually there at the event that's being described, and who is telling me things that may not be in that person's best interest, but they're admitting it anyway. There's all those things and more that are all present in the Gospels in the New Testament.
The Bible is transparent. It's almost as if it's inviting questions on a number of levels. How do skeptics react to these kinds of testimonies? When they look at the evidence of the four gospel writers and everything that you've just mentioned, the time, the dates, where the events happened, how does a skeptic react to these things?
Well, they're going to point out, you think somebody like Bart Ehrman, for example, that there is a distance of time between the events and when it was written in the Gospels. Okay, and we'll admit that Mark's Gospel is probably written sometime in the 60s AD, and that's 30 or so years after the time when this event happened. They're going to point out things like that. What they may not always point out to us is that that's not altogether uncommon in the ancient world for there to be decades between an event and the reporting of that event in a full-fledged form of a full written form. It's not at all uncommon, but that's one of the things that they might push back on. Another one, I think of Bart Ehrman's book, Jesus Before the Gospels, mm-hmm. is going to question the reliability of eyewitness testimony. But what is often missed in that is that the tests that are used to show that eyewitnesses can be in error are usually designed to try to find out how much error there is. They're trying to look for the error, but not only that, most of the errors are in details. They're in the details to the side, the color of the car, the different, there's all sorts of things that are kind of side details mm-hmm. that people do get wrong, but the central events that they're describing, that is rarely something that people get wrong. The one central event they're describing, the car really did hit the other car, or whatever it may be, the big things, they get those correct. Well, it's the same way if we think about the Gospels to do with the resurrection. Now, I happen to believe that every word of the Gospels is absolutely true, but we're talking about right now just talking about the notion of the resurrection. Right. And the stories of the resurrection. And when it comes to the stories of the resurrection, they all agree that Jesus was raised physically from the dead on the third day. Yeah, all of them agree on that. There's no disagreement on that. You have all the Gospels agreeing with that, as well as Mary Magdalene as the first witnesses, as well as the character and the type of the appearances afterwards. All of those, and I've got a chart in the book that actually just shows this so people can actually see this clearly, all of these line up. And so, yes, people that are eyewitnesses may misremember or perceive differently certain details, but the central truths, they get those right and they agree on those. And when they do agree on those, that is a way for us to understand that this is very likely true when you have multiple witnesses agreeing on these specific events, which is what happens in the Gospels.
You know, you look at all of these eyewitnesses, there's so many of them. There's very little incentive to be a witness to this resurrection. The synagogues had already begun casting people out if you had confessed Jesus as the Messiah. So talk about that. What was at stake in the life of an eyewitness at this point?
And you've hit just a very important issue right here, and that is, why would someone keep telling this story once it costs them everything? And I think that's something we have to raise. Why would you keep telling this story once it can cost you everything? Because by the time the eyewitnesses begin to die out, the 50s and 60s and 70s, when that's happening, there is persecution from the Jewish synagogues among the Jews who had not confessed Jesus as Messiah. There is persecution from the Romans beginning in 64. After the fire in Rome. You've got both sides are coming in persecuting, and yet these eyewitnesses persist all the way to the point of death, especially Peter and the two Jameses. Okay. There is so much good evidence for those outside the New Testament. So I'm not even talking about what's inside the New Testament. That's both inside and outside the New Testament. The evidence for Peter and James, the half-brother of Jesus, and James, the disciple of Jesus, for their martyrdoms, for their faith, the evidence is excellent. And if anybody would have known whether or not Jesus was really raised physically from the dead, it would have been those three. They would have known this. And yet they went all the way to the death with nothing to gain. There is no property or wealth that they gain by doing this. There is nothing that they get from being the leader of an offshoot religious movement that's persecuted. There's nothing whatsoever that they can possibly gain from this, yet they persist in it, and they don't merely persist in it, they persist in it to the point of death. And people will die for a lie. That's happened all sorts of times in history, people dying for lies. But people will not typically die for what they know is a lie. And these individuals would not only have died for a lie if Jesus wasn't raised, they would have died for what they knew was a lie. That is very, very unlikely. Mm.
Dr. Jones, a recent Lifeway Research article was published recently, and it is entitled, Americans Believe in Easter Resurrection but Aren't Sure Why It Matters. 66%, they say, of U.S. adults believe in the biblical account, but they don't see a connection between that and their life. As we end this discussion today, I'd like you to make a comment on those people who believe in the resurrection. They believe in the, you know, the biblical account of that, but it's not part of their life. Would you speak to them and describe how essential the resurrection is to our lives?
The resurrection is God's triumph over death, suffering, and evil. And you in your heart, every human being, we feel the weight and the ache of the evil in the world. And just know that if it all stopped at the cross, which is wonderful as what Jesus did through the cross was, if it stopped there, there is no promise from God of ever us having a release from the suffering, the sin, and the death in our world. There's no release from that. It is that he promises us. He triumphs over death. He triumphs over all of these things that came through sin entering into the world through Adam and Eve. And he does this in such a way as to be a public declaration, something that didn't happen in some sort of a mystical experience in a corner under a tree. It's something that happened publicly, physically, outwardly. And because of that, we can be certain and be guaranteed that God will make all things right and new. And the most beautiful part in that is where Mary encounters Jesus and she thinks he is the gardener. And indeed, he is. He is the one through whom the Garden of Eden was planted in the first place. He is the God who walked among the trees with Adam and Eve in the garden, and now here he is. And what he's declaring by that is what was lost in Eden, I am going to restore that, and my resurrection is my promise that I am going to make everything new, and all that was lost in Eden will be restored at the end, and more. That's the beauty, the glory of the resurrection.
Amen. What a reason to celebrate. The booklet we've been talking about is Did the Resurrection Really Happen? You can get not only a single copy, but multiple copies at christianbook.com. And of course, you can order also from crossway.org. If you'd like to find out more about our guest, Dr. Timothy Paul Jones, you can go to his website, timothypauljones.com, and you can check out his podcast, which is simply called The Apologetics Podcast. Dr. Jones, thank you so much for being with us today, helping us celebrate the good news of the resurrection and to give us some answers that we can give to people around us when they're skeptical.
Thank you for having me.
Well, join us next time as we look at the signs of spiritual awakening across the country and discover the one ingredient that can revolutionize our prayer lives. Bill Eliff, pastor and church director for One Cry, will be our guest. If you've enjoyed today's program, you'll love the Stand magazine. Get a free trial subscription at afa.net/thestand. Thanks for listening and join us next time on The Stand Radio.